Welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. Today on the show, we have Dr. Michael Renner, professor of biology and psychology at Drake University, and he's going to talk to us about his work in conservation in Africa. And also joining us, Jesse Lowry. And Jesse, why don't you tell us a little bit about conservation at Blank Park Zoo?
Thanks, Ryan. I'm Jesse Lowry, conservation manager here at Blank Park Zoo. And I always like to start off the show by talking a little bit about the role of modern zoos in saving animals in the wild, the role of modern zoos in conservation more broadly. And so the mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, recreation, education, and research. And what we want to do is invite the community and schools and families to come through our gates and have a good, fun, affordable day out at the zoo. We've surveyed our audience. We know that's what they're looking for. We do a really good job with providing that fun, affordable day out. But while folks are here, we want to incite a behavior change and really encourage some kind of conservation action that's going to help make the environment healthier, help protect wild populations of endangered animals. So I like to call the zoo a window to the wild, a place where people can come and have fun, but then they're inspired to take action to help save animals in our world. And so Blank Park Zoo works on saving animals and conservation in many different ways. The first thing is we try to be as sustainable as possible in our day-to-day operations. I think there's a real direct connection between being green and saving animals. Definitely what we consume, what we throw away affects the local environment, as well as just going right down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico as well. And so we have vermiculture, some worms that eat part of our garbage. We compost. We have a lot of LED lights. Of course, we recycle. And we're trying to improve every single day on being green here at Blank Park Zoo. We do a lot locally. If you want to get the most bang for your buck, taking care of the local environment is very important. A couple examples is our upcycle program, where we remove invasive species from local parks, like honeysuckle and mulberry. And it just so happens that they're favorite treat items of some of our critters here at Blank Park Zoo. We also have our Plant Grow Fly program, encouraging folks to plant butterfly gardens, an easy thing that people can do to help save wildlife. But really, the backbone of what a modern zoo can do to help these endangered animals is to support field projects, support those individuals and organizations that are out on the front lines in the range countries of many of the animals that we have here at Blank Park Zoo. We give about $70,000 every year to In the Wild Conservation. And some examples are Giraffe Conservation Foundation in Namibia and other countries. We have Hornbill Research Foundation in Thailand, International Rhino Foundation, which works to save rhinos in every country in which they exist, Conservation Fusion that works in Madagascar, and we do a lot of work in the neck of the woods where Michael's going to be talking about today. Our most notable project is Chimpanzee Sanctuary and Wildlife Conservation Trust in Uganda. That's something that Blank Park Zoo and modern zoos can really do to help save animals in the wild. We're really excited to be able to do this work. And I always like to point out the reason why we can do this work is because of the support of the community. Because every time you come to Blank Park Zoo, a portion of all revenue made at the zoo goes to these programs. And so it doesn't matter if you're coming just on a warm, sunny day to enjoy the zoo, or maybe you get married at the zoo, or maybe you come to Zoo Brew, you are helping to save animals in the wild. So it's really a direct connection. And so now I'd like to really, again, welcome Michael to our program here. And we're excited, Michael, to hear about your work in Africa. But why don't we start with just talking a little bit about your background and your position at Drake University?
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm a professor at Drake University, and I'm split across three departments. I'm a professor of psychology, biology, and environmental science. The environmental science program is sort of my home. And it's because my work in the last decade or so has shifted much more into conservation areas than my basic background in neuroscience and animal behavior. We have an environmental science program that has two majors. There's an environmental science program, and there's also a sustainability and resilience curriculum that's fairly new for us. My own background is kind of a long and winding path because I actually didn't start working in conservation areas. I started in neuroscience, and my curiosity about that led me to some questions about animal behavior. And in working with animal behavior, I ended up working at the Philadelphia Zoo in conjunction with being a faculty member at another university for about 10 years, I guess. And that led me into the whole world of wildlife conservation. I took a bit of a break from my science career and worked as an administrator for a while. And then in 2011, I got involved in the project in Rwanda that we'll be talking about. After the genocide in Rwanda ended in 1994, the Gishwati Forest was nearly destroyed. There was a period of time where the government wasn't really functioning, and a couple of million refugees who'd been in other countries for sometimes a couple of decades flowed back into the country, and they were looking for places to live and places to farm. And so without any kind of controls to protect the forest, it was nearly disappeared by people cutting down trees thinking they could make farmland out of it. Something a lot of people don't know is that rainforest land is never good farmland because the nutrient cycle in a rainforest is all based on very quick turnover. And so, you know, Iowa has, in some places, very deep, rich topsoil. Rainforest essentially has no topsoil. It's essentially a clay foundation in the ground, and all of the nutrients are stored in the plant material, and anything that dies is immediately recycled into new plants. So many of the trees were cut down, but it turned out it wasn't very good farmland, and so the people in that area really struggle. And Gishwati is a really interesting forest. There had been deforestation for decades before that, but it is a biodiversity hotspot. Not only are there chimpanzees, but there are several other species of primates. There are about 100 species of birds. There are jackals and servals and all kinds of other really interesting critters there. And in 2007, Ted Townsend, who's a local philanthropist, got involved in the project to try to stabilize it and protect it from disappearing completely by going to the Clinton Global Initiative Summit. And he made the commitment, along with President Kagame of Rwanda, that they would try to stabilize this forest and eventually let it begin to grow back into itself and set the target that it would become a national park over time. I got involved in the project in about 2011, by which point the forest was stabilized, but they were having a lot of trouble along the boundaries in terms of conflict between the animals in the preserve and the farmers in the local area. The forest was really too small to support the populations that it had, so the animals would come out and try to find additional food by raiding the agricultural crops. Farmers didn't like that, and you know these are subsistence farmers. These are not people who are raising crops to sell for money. These are people who are raising crops to feed their families. And so anytime that crop disappears, that's a problem. That conflict was undermining people's support for preserving this area, and the long-term future of having a national park that people would come to as tourists was really at risk. And people who are trying to feed their family this week have a hard time thinking in 5 years it's going to be really great, there'll be tourists, and there'll be money that come with the tourists.
And so with many projects, you're really working to help uplift the local community, and you've got challenges there of people trying to raise their families and grow food when the soil is not very rich like it is here in Iowa, and also the depletion of the habitat for the wildlife. And so you've got that human-wildlife conflict kind of happening at the same time.
Exactly. Those of us in the conservation world really like to take the long view because we need to think about preserving this habitat or this species for the next 100 or next 1,000 years. But if you're trying to put food on your family for this week, food on the table for your family this week, 1,000 years from now is not terribly interesting to you. And so because I have a background in primatology, they asked me to get involved and see if we could solve this problem of the chimpanzees coming out of the forest and raiding the agricultural crops. So we spent some time hiking the mountains around there. Rwanda is a very volcanic place. The history of it is that most of the hills are actually old dead volcanoes, and so they're very steep and very rocky. One of the study sites I work at has 1,000 feet of vertical change from the top of the hill to the bottom, and you're up and down that all day. And in the process of getting acquainted with it, taking a bunch of measurements, I came up with an idea that I thought maybe explained why the chimpanzees were, or not why they were coming out. We knew that. That's food. But how they were making the decision to come out. Where do you come out and make a raid of the corn that's out there, and where do you not come out? And we tested that hypothesis in a series of field studies, and it turned out it pretty well explained where they would and wouldn't make crop raids. So by suggesting to the local farmers that they might change the way they use their land, not mandatory, but essentially if you change the way you use the land and you do these things, you might reduce the amount of raiding, we were actually able to get that problem under control. And so now the community, because of that and because of a number of other projects that a group I work with has taken on, The forest is recognized as a really important resource. It helps them with their future. There's no way you can do one simple project and stabilize the forest or fix a community. You have to take a systems level approach. And so the Forest of Hope Association is a Rwandan nonprofit that I work with. And they've taken on a number of projects in terms of community development. They sponsor eco clubs in the schools so that the kids learn about ecology and the forest ecosystem. They underwrite a craft cooperative, which then makes jobs for some of the local people. We support the schools. We built a library in the village of Kinahira, which then helps them with their education. We have grants for beekeeping and for other agricultural products. And really, it's a community development project, of which my animal behavior piece is really only a small part.
We have some guidelines as to what kind of projects that we support here at Blank Park Zoo. And all of the things that you're saying is exactly the kind of the projects that we support. We want to make sure that we take a holistic approach to conservation, that we look at the health of individual animals, the health of animal populations, the health of the environment, and most importantly, the health of the local people, because they're all intertwined, and many of the biological diversity hotspots around the world are also places of crushing human poverty. And so by uplifting those local communities, we can make gains in helping the human communities as well as the wildlife. And I think that the project that you've been working on over in Rwanda is a wonderful example of that. And I'm glad to see that you're having some successes. Tell us about what kind of changes did the folks make to avoid the crop raiding with the chimpanzees? How did the chimpanzees make that decision to raid this garden or raid this garden?
I'll try to keep it from being too arcane. Part of my background is in animal cognition. And so as I was looking at it, not from the standpoint of agriculture or from the standpoint of forestry, but from the standpoint of animal behavior, I noticed that there was a pattern that where the land form was more complicated, where the surface of the ground was essentially not a smooth slope. And there's nothing flat in Rwanda, so you never get flat. But it wasn't a smooth slope. There were pockets and hills and ridges and things in it. It was tougher to see the ground very far away from you. And that led me to guess that because we also know that chimpanzees are risk averse, they don't like to take a lot of chances. They know they're at risk when they come out of the forest because that's not their natural place to be. That my guess was that they would probably be pretty cautious about coming out unless they could at any particular moment in time imagine their escape route that would get them back into the forest safely. And so when you apply that idea, you can start looking at the land and saying, all right, here's a place where a chimpanzee who was on the ground outside the forest wouldn't be able to see the ground all the way back to the forest, and they'd probably be more uncomfortable there than a place where they could. And so we took a series of relatively complicated measurements with GPS tagging the locations on the ground, and then coming back here and doing work in our GIS system to make a very complicated 3D map of the terrain around there, saying a chimpanzee stands about a meter tall, about 35, 40 inches tall. So if we put their eyes at a meter tall and estimate how far can you see and still see the ground, that let us draw maps of where they could and couldn't essentially imagine these escape routes. And in using that to make predictions, we'd said if plants were inside the range where they could see the ground all the way back to the forest, they would probably raid them. And if they were outside that range, they wouldn't. And it turned out that model worked.
So how much shuffling or shifting did the people actually have to do? What percentage of the plants in the gardens had to be moved?
The way they do agriculture there is not high tech. It's all hand labor. There are very few farm implements in Rwanda, partly because it's an incredibly poor country, and partly because the land is so steep and so rocky. There are just a lot of the things that we take for granted in Iowa that just don't work there. They have to use more natural and organic methods of keeping their land healthy and maximizing their crop yield. So they do a lot of crop rotation. They graze some land. They plant beans. They plant corn. They have not a system, but they know they can't do the same thing over and over. And so all they really had to do was to change their land use pattern so that they didn't plant corn within that what we call the sightline zone, where the chimpanzees could get to that spot and still see an escape route for themselves. And so farmers have now tended to start using the land that's right along the edge of the forest as grazing land more than they had before. The chimpanzees will fuss with beans a little bit, but they don't do nearly as much damage. Part of the problem with the chimpanzee raiding corn is that they don't look at it the same way we do. We look at the corn ears as being the food source. They like to knock the whole plant down and then treat the corn stalk as if it's essentially sugarcane. It has a fluid in it that's sweet, and they like that. And so to a farmer, that just looks like vandalism because they knock the corn down, they leave the ears behind, and so now they've destroyed the crop, but they haven't taken the part the farmer considers valuable. They've just ruined it. Their use of corn in preference to other things means that that's what you really have to manage. So if the farmers manage their crop rotation so that the corn isn't the thing that's right close to the forest, that works. And so for the most part, the crop rates have stopped. And once in a while, you get a farmer who buys land who wasn't part of those conversations, who plants corn, and all the other locals go, don't do that, it's not going to work. And he says, it'll be fine. And then the chimpanzees come out and raid that crop, and next year he doesn't plant it there anymore.
Tell us more about the relationship with those local people and what kind of feedback you've been getting with all of the scientific research and efforts that you've been doing.
Well, we have a field station that we share with a number of other organizations in the village of Kinihira, which is at the south edge of Gishwati National Park. Actually, it did become a national park last year. And so they're used to having people coming in and out to do research there, but there isn't a lot of traffic. And so there are times that when I arrived to do some work there for a few weeks, the last person that they saw who wasn't from that region was me. So you're always the best show in town. And the kids in the village just love meeting you and talking to you. And, you know, they want to hear all about your world, but there are so few parts of our world that are even vaguely familiar to them. It's kind of tough to have a conversation sometimes. The other problem that I have personally is that the local language is Kinyarwanda, which is a Bantu language like Swahili. And I'm terrible at languages. And so I know a little bit of Kinyarwanda, but not nearly enough to have a fluid, you know, easy conversation. So I'm always working pretty hard to communicate effectively. There was one day that we had been up and down the mountains all day, and my little step counter congratulated me on having climbed 200 flights of stairs and walked 17 miles that day. And I was just dragging my way out to the road to get back to the field station. And this little kid, he had to be about 5 years old, looked at me, and in all seriousness, with a big smile on his face, he said, in Kinyarwanda, be strong, old man. And I couldn't tell whether to laugh or cry because it was such a cute moment. And he was so earnest that, you know, he thought I might not make it back out to the road because I looked pretty bad at that point.
That's a pretty funny mental image. And I can only imagine walking 17 miles up that elevation. Fantastic, you know, stories and information about the local people. Let's talk about the habitat. You started out by talking about all the trees that were cut down and the habitat destruction. Tell us about what's happening on that end.
When the project started, there was only a very small stub of the rainforest that was left. And all the chimpanzees and most of the larger wildlife had all retreated into that area as the forest got cut from the edges in toward the center. Very quickly, the government identified a footprint of land that was legally still part of the reserve and that no one questioned that. And they started, you know, helping the local folks understand where the boundary was and that land was not available to be used. Since then, actually, and partly in result of the efforts of Mr. Townsend, they actually bought considerable extra land around it. And then when the park was gazetted as a national park last year, they drew the boundaries differently to include even more land. And the local farmers who had been using that land, even though they didn't own it, are being compensated for that. One of the complications of doing conservation work in many parts of the world is that the land tenure history is very murky. And in Rwanda, there has never been a land registry that established clearly who owned what until very recently. So the park is growing back into a sustainable size, but it will require support for a few more years yet before that happens. The biodiversity is really astounding. They have everything from the forest giants, the Umshwari trees, the other species of trees that are, you know, sometimes 200 feet tall, and down to butterflies that have probably never been identified by science.
What's the current political situation in Rwanda?
It's very difficult to talk about that in ways that just make easy sense to people who are living in a country with a 240-year stable democracy. After the genocide finished in 1994, there was no functional government. Frankly, there were no social conventions. There was very little infrastructure. The country was, for all practical purposes, destroyed. They established an interim government, which eventually became a permanent government after they had passed a new constitution. And at that time, the term limits for the office of president were that two terms was the maximum. Since about the year 2000, President Paul Kagame has been in office. Last year, there was a petition movement. It was a very unusual situation. that didn't come from any recognized political operatives. It truly looked like a grassroots movement, and international observers have said that they see no evidence of any shenanigans going on. There was a grassroots movement petition to request the parliament to change the constitution to allow Mr. Kagame a third term. He was silent on this, and in fact, the one interview he gave, he said he didn't want to do it. But that petition was signed by about half of the population of Rwanda. The parliament changed the constitution to allow a third term, and at that point, Mr. Kagame said that he would run, but he would not do a fourth term under any circumstances. So he was just inaugurated actually a couple of weeks ago for a third 7-year term as president, because that's how their constitution works. It's considered to be one of the most stable democracies in Africa, and Rwanda is also an extraordinarily safe place. I think they were shaken, you know, beyond to the core by what happened in the 1990s. And there is a very strong social ethos of peace and courtesy. And, you know, and frankly, there's a substantial police presence as well. But I feel safer walking the streets of Kigali at night than I do in most U.S. cities, because there's just very little violent crime. There is property crime. There is just theft because everybody's poor. But you're not personally in danger in almost any circumstance in Rwanda. It's kind of extraordinary. I've done research there for a number of years, and I did research for a couple of years and was in and out quite a few times before I got to the comfort level that I was willing to take students with me, because I just wasn't sure at first what the circumstance was going to be. I've taken a number of students there. I actually took a class last year of 14 students, and there will be another class this coming January. And the students have an extraordinary experience there, and there's no point at which anybody feels that their personal security is at risk. It's very unusual.
We certainly hope for the continued stability and peace for the folks who live in that area. Let's continue to talk about the conservation work there, some successes. But before that, please talk a little bit more about the animal species that are there, and what's the conservation status of some of these species? What's at stake here?
The honest answer to the question is the reason it's so important to preserve Gishwadi is, you know, beyond the moral imperative, is that we don't know. We've described roughly 2 million of the species on the planet. Most of the biological models out there say that there are somewhere between 6 and 10 million species. So we barely scratched the surface of what's out there. And frankly, other models say much higher numbers of species. I came home with a picture from my first excursion into Gishwadi Forest. I was deep into the forest. And I saw a butterfly I didn't recognize. And I'm not a huge butterfly expert, but I can name some of them. And I snapped a picture of this butterfly. It was actually quite a good picture. And I took it and showed it to a colleague of mine who's a butterfly specialist. And he said, I don't think that species has been described yet. Now, that's not nearly enough information to name the species. You need a lot more data than that. It has to be collected in particular ways. There are very strict rules to make sure we don't start spouting nonsense as scientists. But it was just an example of how easy it is to come across species that we don't know anything about. And in these biodiversity hotspots is where many of those species will be found. So there is the eastern subspecies of the common chimpanzee, Pantroglodytes. There are 4 or 5 other species of primates. There is one species that is in the guidebooks as being present in Gishwadi that I've never seen, so I'm not sure of the number. There are any number of other small mammal species. There are well over 200 species of birds that people think are there. They've documented about 180. The plant biodiversity is comparable. There are just wonders to be discovered there. And since many of our industrial products, many of our drugs, many of our chemicals come from natural products, every time a species goes extinct, even if you don't care about the protecting the planet aspect, we're giving up a resource that Mother Nature has had millions of years to evolve that might have solved a problem we need solved. And we can't use that resource if it's not here anymore.
Conservation is actually a pretty selfish field. We're trying to make sure that we take care of the earth and all the things that sustain humans. So besides habitat destruction, I'm sure that's one of the big ones, what else are these animals facing, that's making them more rare?
That's the primary problem at this point. The community education that's been such a big project around that part of Rwanda has the local community very much in support of protecting the forest. When the project started 10 years ago, there was an awful lot of kind of one-off situations where people would go into the forest to graze their cattle in the small clearings and to harvest plants for their craft work. They were using the forest in ways that were not really sustainable. and they didn't know not to, and no one had told them it was a protected area. And once the education started, that didn't solve itself, but it was relatively easy to manage, and people came to accept that this was a special protected place. So the other kinds of things that you see that are often a threat to biodiversity in conservation areas really are not that much of a problem there. The problem is that Rwanda is the most densely populated country in Africa. There are 12 million people there in an area about the size of a quarter of Iowa. And so you never go anywhere that you don't see people. I've been, you know, traveling even, you know, in the overnight hours, and there are always people walking along the roads, very few of which are paved. You have trouble outside of conservation areas finding areas where you can see for a great distance and not see human artifacts, houses, and even now power lines are starting to go in. There's just so much pressure on the habitat because of the human population that protecting the area so that the animals and plants can be there and have their existence, that's the big challenge.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Please start to close by talking about your hopes for the future for this site.
For this site, I think we're in a good place in terms of the trajectory we're on. There are a lot of things that could go wrong, but the idea that the forest would be stabilized has been accomplished. The idea that it would be recognized as a reserve area and that we could educate the local folk that it was in their long-term best interest to not cut it down, and that's been done. The long-term goal of the project initially was to turn it into Rwanda's fourth national park. And just over a year and a half ago, that happened. It is now Gishwati Makura National Park. There's another forest fragment a few miles away that was incorporated with it, and the plan is eventually to build a corridor so that the wildlife can move back and forth between those two areas. We will get there eventually, but that's a long, slow process. So my hope for it is that it remains stable and that it continue to be protected and that it be allowed to grow back into the mighty rainforest that it once was.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
If you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, go to the website, blankparkzoo.com. You'll find all sorts of information about our hours and activities, events, and there's a huge section on conservation. You can join our Plant Grow Fly initiative and help protect native pollinators right here in Iowa. Well, that's all the time we have for today, so join us next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.